Welcome to the John Chapman Show, where we talk about retirement readiness, strategies to help you grow and preserve your wealth so that you get the most from life with the money you do have. Are you on track? John is an employee of WorthPoint LLC. All opinions expressed by John and podcast guests are solely their own opinion and do not necessarily reflect the opinion of WorthPoint. This podcast should not be relied upon for investment decisions and is for informational purposes only.
My guest this week is Michael Fink, professor of financial planning at Texas Tech University and a professor of wealth management at the American College of Financial Services. It was a huge honor to host Michael, since I've been a huge fan of his over the years. It's too long to read his entire CV, but I want to touch on a few of his major accomplishments. First, Michael received his PhD in finance from the University of Missouri in 2011. He also received a PhD in family resource management from The Ohio State University in 1998. He also has a BS in economics and a BA in English in 1993 from The Ohio State University. And over the years, Michael has won over 30 awards for his research and his papers, some of which include the Best Paper Award from the Academy of Financial Services, as well as the Montgomery Warschauer Best Paper Award, and on and on. But what really caught my attention from Michael's work is his focus on retirement planning, and specifically his paper in 2013 that he co-authored with Wade Fow and David Planchette titled Low Bond Yields and Safe Portfolio Withdrawal Rates, as well as his paper in 2018 with the same co-authors titled Low Returns and Optimal Saving Rates. We covered a range of topics on this show, so if you're in your 50s and 60s, or you're just wanting to better understand how to best prepare for the realities of investing and for retirement for the future, you're going to get so much out of this episode. Be sure to subscribe to the show. You could leave a comment or a rating, or you could reach out to me directly by emailing me at thejohnchapmanshow@gmail.com. Again, a big thank you to Michael for joining me this week. And without further ado, let's dive into it. Michael, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate you being here. With all of your experience as a retirement researcher, I'm curious what you make of the landscape today for, let's say, somebody that's in their mid-50s. What are some of the challenges or issues that they have to bump up against in order to try to save for a successful retirement?
Well, you know, it's not a fantastic time to be a nearly retiree. There's no other way to put it. There are some challenges. And I think the biggest challenge is that we're in a low interest rate environment. What are the implications of being in a low interest rate environment? That means that your safe investments are not going to grow as much. If you're 55 years old, that means that you need to save more to fund the same income in retirement. The other challenge is that especially people who make more money, they live longer. And that's good news, generally speaking. It's better than the alternative. But living longer means that retirement is more expensive. So if you compare a retiree today to a retiree in the early 1980s, it's going to cost them about twice as much, even before inflation. So essentially, if you had $1 million in 1982, it would buy you the same income as $2 million before correcting for inflation. But after you correct for inflation, that's more like $4 million. So you need to have $4 million today at age 65 to buy the same lifestyle as $1 million in the early 1980s. And the reason is because bonds have a lower real after inflation interest rate and people are living longer. So you've raised the cost of funding a lifestyle in retirement. And what you're seeing is that a lot of pensions are facing this reality. They don't have enough money to fund the cost of creating income for retirees. And I think we get a false sense of how expensive it is to fund a secure and safe lifestyle in retirement using safe investments like bonds. And what often happens is people then feel like their only alternative is to take more risk. But of course, risk is real. And risk means that things could not go well. And I think what you're seeing is that a lot of people are trying to reach for those higher returns, right. And that's pushing up prices of stocks and even riskier types of bonds to the extent that the bonus that you can expect to get from investing in those investments is not what it was historically. So when I say it's kind of a depressing time to talk about retirement, it is. You know, it's just the reality that we're all facing. Mm. And part of it is just that we have the largest and wealthiest generation of near retirees in the history of the United States that are all, you know, buying stocks and bonds at the same time. So part of what planning for that is just sort of accepting that new reality.
Yeah, well, I think that there is something important to accepting that new reality, because my fear is that people either will be ignorant to it and they'll just be focused on their work and their family, or people that are aware of that, the challenges that they face, they'll just avoid them and push it off till later. And especially as what I see in my financial planning practice is that, you know, not everybody is willing to take it head on and deal with it, because it means some potential harsh realities, things like saving more or working longer, or a combination of both, or lower expectations for living standards. Those are not fun things to talk about in client meetings, Michael.
No, not at all. You know, and that's been the mantra really among those of us who do retirement research is save more and work longer. I mean, that is the reality that we're living with right now. But you know, that's okay. The data shows that staying in the workforce a little bit longer doesn't really have a negative impact on our life satisfaction. In fact, there's some evidence that we're able to maintain human contact better through a workforce than we are after we retire. There's a lot of upside to that. Don't see it as a potential plus that the market is encouraging you to stay in the workforce a little bit longer. It's encouraging you to delay Social Security. And you know, really, by extending your work life, it has a huge impact on the sustainability of your retirement lifestyle, because it's 1 year less that you have to fund with your savings, and you have an additional year of saving. And if you're delaying Social Security, you know, you may be getting as much as 8% more in Social Security income per year. So it has a really big marginal impact if you can delay retirement from, say, 62 or 63 to 67 or 68 or 69. And it's probably not going to have a huge impact on your overall life satisfaction.
Yeah, that's a helpful shift in perspective, because someone, maybe that's the context of somebody that doesn't have an enjoyable workplace, might feel as if working longer is more painful. But at the flip side of that might be that there's still a way for them to earn income. It delays their spending of their assets, and it gives them maybe a sense of community if they can find a good work environment. In the paper that you wrote with David Blanchett and Wade Fowle in 2017, Low Returns and Optimal Savings Rates, I just want to read a quote from that. You guys wrote, optimal savings would need to rise by roughly 2/3 for most Americans, and higher income workers are most at risk of undersaving if they use historical asset returns. So maybe one topic I'd like for you to introduce is, why are higher income workers at risk, and what should actually the goal be? What we need to talk about income replacement and what people are actually saving for in the future. So why are higher income workers more at risk?
Well, I mean, basically they have to save more because Social Security is going to make up less of their lifestyle, the amount of money that they'll actually spend in retirement. So they're going to have a bigger gap. And especially baby boomers, they don't have the pensions that older retirees have. So they're, you know, if you're making $150,000 per year, you might get $30,000 from Social Security. But you've got to make up the difference in your lifestyle from your savings. You're not going to be able to rely on pensions to make up that gap. And it's going to be more expensive, as we just talked about before. So there is a bigger risk. Now, the good news is, and I think it is sort of good news, that we very often overestimate how much people need. So you're making $150,000 of gross income, but you're not spending $150,000. You have to pay for payroll taxes. So, you know, that money for Social Security and Medicare, that gets taken out of your paycheck. It doesn't get taken out of your income after you retire. So that's something that you don't have to pay for. You're also saving maybe 15% of your income for retirement. You don't have to save anymore for retirement because you're in retirement. So what we find is that the actual amount of money that you spend in retirement for a higher income worker may be closer to 50 or 60% of their gross income. So if you're making, you know, $200,000, then maybe the lifestyle that you need to replace is about $10,000 per month. Now, Social Security is going to make up part of it, but you're going to have to make up the rest of it with savings in a relatively low interest rate environment. And you also have to sort of round up because you're going to have to pay some taxes in retirement.
Good point.
So calculating that number is, I think, you know, maybe reassuring for some retirees who think that they have to come up with $200,000 a year replace their lifestyle. That's not necessary, but it's still going to be expensive to come up with maybe the extra $60,000 or $70,000 per year from your savings when, if you retire at, say, 65, you have, if you're a healthy couple, you may have a 10% chance that one of you is going to live to 100. So that's, you've got a plan for, you know, spreading your savings over the course of maybe 35 years.
So that's another question that I wanted to ask you about, because in 2013, you wrote a paper also with the same two guys, and you talked about withdrawal rates or spending money from your portfolio. And that was back in 2013, which feels like eons ago. And I'm curious, I wish we could take a poll of the listeners out there, and I want for them to guess what they think the 10-year treasury yield was back in 2013. Michael, do you recall, like, in September of 2013, what the yield was on the 10-year treasury?
Oh man, you know, it was pretty low at the time that we wrote that paper, but definitely not as low as what it is right now. I'd say the 10-year may have been about 2%. What do you think?
It was about 2.5%. Towards the end of 2013, it rose a little bit, but it started the year about 2%. It ended the year about 2.9. And today, what is the 10-year treasury rate, just as a frame of reference for comparison?
God, I haven't checked in a little while. I'm guessing maybe, you know, 70 basis points.
70 basis points. You're exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. So we've gone, you wrote the paper talking about low rates, but in 2013, when rates were 70% higher than where they are right now. So, I can't even imagine what your research would say, you know, if you were to rewrite that. But let's just talk about, you know, the old school frame of reference. So the 4% rule. Talk to us about what were some of the underlying assumptions in the old days about how much money people could safely take out of their portfolio.
Let's talk about what the 4% rule means. So if you have $1 million, a financial advisor named Bill Bangen back in 1994 estimated, using historical periods, how much you could have safely withdrawn from that $1 million per year to fund lifestyle between the ages of 65 and 95, so a 30-year time horizon. And what he found was that there seems to be this floor at about 4%. So 4% would mean $40,000 the first year, but that amount rises with inflation each year. He wanted to make sure that your lifestyle stayed the same in retirement. So he incorporated inflation, he incorporated bond returns and stock returns, and he saw that there was this floor in the United States of about 4% per year. And then Wade Fow, one of my co-authors, did an article where he looked at international safe withdrawal rates, and he found that because asset returns were not so great in some other countries, we kind of got lucky in the United States. We had great stock and bond returns over the course of the 20th century, but in other countries, it wasn't so great. And actually, if you aggregate it, it's probably closer to about 3%. And then if you consider the fact that rates of return are probably going to be lower going forward, then the margin of safety for the 4% rule can go from maybe, you know, 95% using historical numbers down to closer to 50% using the price of stocks that we have today. And because the price of stocks are a good indicator of the expected return on stocks and the bond returns that we have today, which are historically low. What is unusual about today is that you have simultaneously very low yields on bonds, but also very expensive prices on stocks. And there have been historical periods where, you know, stocks were not performing very well, but they were also very cheap. And, you know, maybe yields on bonds were low at the same time that stocks were very cheap. And eventually stocks went back up again and they saved people's retirements. But we're in a bit of an unusual situation right now.
Very unusual. And I know that a lot of people express frustration, especially being, let's say, in their 60s with what they feel like is expensive stocks, what are expensive stocks and low yields. So I'm curious, though, when people actually start spending money, we talked about there are some challenges. Maybe they need to spend a little bit less of their portfolio than we previously thought. But you've done a lot of research on retirement happiness. And it sounds as if there's ways that you can spend money that might make your retirement more enjoyable versus others. So talk to us a little bit about what your research has shown about retirement happiness.
Yeah, you know, the research in life satisfaction really confirms this idea that we are social beings, that we get a lot of happiness from being around other humans. And in retirement, the same thing happens, that if we isolate ourselves in retirement, we're significantly less happy. But if we spend our money on what we like to call social spending categories, so going out to dinner with friends or going on vacations, this is maybe sort of a post-COVID type of conversation, but those are the kind of things. Being more social is really what makes us happiest in retirement. And what we see is that there are people who have less money saved, but are actually happier in retirement because they're doing a better job of maintaining social engagement than other people who are using their money in ways that are isolating them. I mean, do not go buy a cabin in the woods for retirement because, you know, it'll be kind of nice to be isolated for maybe the first week. But after that, it's just kind of, what do you do now? You know, it's not very much fun. And I've actually done interviews with retirees. I did an interview with one woman who at the age of 55 sold a very successful business and moved to the coast of Mexico because she visited Mexico. She always loved the coast of Mexico. And she lasted about a month and a half before she got sick of it and sold the place and moved back to where all her friends were.
How interesting. So
I think that it's important to recognize that building a lifestyle in retirement, it means thinking consciously about what type of environment is going to give me the best opportunities for social interaction. Because if I'm living in a kind of environment where I'm more likely to be isolated, I'm probably going to be less happy.
That's really interesting. So another thing that I'm thinking about is just the spending patterns of retirees. And it seems like there's been some research done about how much people actually spend within the different phases of their retirement, the go-go, slow-go, no-go phases. So what does some of the research suggest about how people are actually spending money once they do retire?
Yeah, you know, that whole idea, this go-go, slow-go, and no-go concept of retirement was developed before we really have the data to show whether or not that's actually what happened. And when we got the data, that's actually pretty true. I mean, people spend a lot of money early on in retirement, and the rate of spending falls most rapidly about in your mid-70s. Hmm. And then in your 80s and 90s, you're still spending a little less every year. But that rate of decline is not as much as it was in your 70s because you're spending more money on healthcare. But the good news about spending money on healthcare in retirement is that if you do have very high health expenses, you're not spending a whole lot of money on other stuff. So it sort of moderates the amount of money that you're spending in total. And so, you spend a lot more money early on in retirement. And it's one of the reasons that especially wealthy retirees don't end up spending down their money in retirement is because they may spend a lot of money the second and third year of retirement, but then they develop a routine. And, you know, I've done interviews with retirees where they brag about how little money they're spending in retirement. They're clipping coupons, they're getting senior discounts, they're eating at McDonald's. And I'm like, well, that's wonderful. But, you know, you have saved all this money, and this must mean that you really want to give money to your children. And they say, no, you know, we pay for their college education. They've got plenty of money. They don't need it. And I sort of look at them and I say, well, that's it. Like, there's only two options.
Right. What else is there? Yourself,
or it's going to go to your kids. And, you know, I really am proud of you that you're not spending very much money, but, you know, you've got to be I think much more deliberate about what you want from retirement. That you know, maybe I want this legacy to give to pass on to whoever, but I the rest of it I can use for a lifestyle. So what can I do to get the most out of my retirement? How can I feel comfortable actually spending that money? I think a lot of people just spend their whole life being so proud of themselves that they're thrifty, and then they get to retirement and they have a difficult time turning around and being a little bit less thrifty.
Yeah, there's a lot that that makes me think of. One is the role of the advisor, and I'm saying this just from my own point of view, of potentially giving permission to retirees to spend, or helping them understand how they can appropriately spend in the right way. And there's just this friction. You know, on the one hand, we were just talking a few minutes ago about how potentially underfunded a lot of people are for their retirement, and the risks that, you know, they have with low yields and high stock prices. And at the same time, now we're talking about how little people actually do spend. And so maybe there is less of a risk of them running out of money because they gear their lifestyles towards being frugal. And so that's just, those are competing ideas in the retirement landscape. And I find that that's funny. Something else that that's making me think of is the use of income annuities, because income annuities force you to spend that money. And, you know, you sort of write it off in your head when you start to annuitize that. So this is such a polarizing topic. I can't help but just talk about it now. And I've seen both sides of it. So talk to me a little bit about, just from your perspective as a researcher, what does the research suggest about the role or not of an income annuity?
Well, let's first talk about what an income annuity is. You know, in the old days, you would hand your money to an employer, and the employer would promise you an income for life. And so a part of your paycheck would go to contribute to a pension. And when you got to retirement, that pension would then provide you a certain amount of money per month, as long as you were alive. Now, you can replicate that by taking part of the money that you saved in your 401k and handing it over to an insurance company. And because the insurance company understands how long you can be expected to live, they can come up with an estimate of how much they can pay you fairly every month from the amount of money that you pay for that income annuity. So you can take a chunk of your nest egg and say, I want to turn it into the same thing that my dad got, or my mom, which is a pension, which is a monthly income for the rest of my life. And a lot in economics, we often talk about the failure to buy an annuity as a puzzle, because really, if you have money sitting around in safe investments like CDs or money markets or bonds, then you could pull a certain amount of money out of that savings every month to fund spending. But the problem is you don't know how long you're going to live.
Right.
Which is the value of going to an insurance company and saying, you know what, instead of doing this myself, I'm going to hand the money over to you. And then you can give me an income as if I was going to live to the average longevity, which is about what an annuity pays. And then if I live longer than the average longevity, you have to keep making payments to me. Now, the trade-off is that if I only live 10 years in retirement, I'm essentially subsidizing the one who lives 40 years in retirement. Mm-hmm. And as most economists would say, well, you don't care because you're dead. So that's that shouldn't bother you very much. Either way, when you were alive, you could spend more money and not have to worry about running out. So that's the value of annuitization. It also gives you license to spend part of your nest egg without feeling guilty, because you know it's not going to run out. You know, I give my mother as an example, because my mother has a pension, a traditional pension, which is like an annuity, and she feels comfortable spending that money every month, but she does not feel as comfortable pulling money out of her 401k to fund spending, because that would seem risky. But to her, money that she knows is going to show up every month, it's not risky to spend that money. So psychologically, you know, in addition to being mathematically more efficient, it can be psychologically more efficient as well. So I'm a big fan of partial annuitization.
Okay, I want to talk about that, because something that I've come up across quite often and have for the past number of years is pension lump sums. Someone that works at a company, they previously had a retirement plan through a pension, and the employer comes to them maybe after a merger and acquisition or just because it's too expensive, and they say, here, take the present value and just dump it into your IRA account. And my fear is that people are lured into you know, all of the dollar amounts, all the zeros, and they think, man, I can double or triple my net worth in just one stroke of a pen. And so the big fear is what you're talking about, the psychological aspect of this. So how have you done, or have you done any research on pension lump sums and sort of the challenges that retirees need to think about?
Well, they're not going to offer you the lump sum if it is a market, if it's a fair market rate of return. So the thing is, you have to go out on the marketplace and do a quote for how much it would cost to buy the same amount of income every year for life, compare it to the lump sum that they're offering you. And very often the lump sum that they're offering you is far less than the cost you would have to pay in the private market to buy the same lifetime income. So unless you have a big liquidity need, or you know your health is not very good, you know, there's some reasons why you would want to have the lump sum, but they're probably not going to make that offer to someone who's in poor health if they can get away with it. And sometimes what will happen is what's known as adverse selection. They'll make an offer like that, and it'll be just the ones who are not going to live as long anyway who end up taking it, and the ones who take the annuity are the ones who would have lived longer anyway. So there's some issues with companies offering it. They can't be as generous as you would need them to be if you're a healthy person to be able to compensate you for the loss of that income.
Yeah, fascinating. So something you just talked about made me think about healthcare expenses in retirement. And that may be one of those background things that causing people to not want to spend too much. So in another podcast that you had with Christine Benz at Morningstar, you talked about the different perceptions for people that had purchased long-term care insurance versus those that haven't. So what does some of your research suggest about those that have long-term care insurance? How do they feel about having that type of insurance when they get to retirement?
Well, I mean, the purpose of insurance is to protect you against a worst case scenario. And in retirement, a worst case scenario are, you know, experience a long-term care event and having to pay a lot of money out of pocket for it, or living a very long time and then having to have a very expensive retirement to fund your lifestyle. And that's what insurance is for. Insurance is there to protect you against that worst case scenario. And what we find is that ones, people who have actually protected themselves against that potential large risk are significantly happier in retirement, because that's a burden that they don't have to bear. And they feel more comfortable spending money because they know that they don't have to keep a certain amount of money set aside. Even if you've got like $500,000 set aside to fund a potential extended long-term care event, that still may not be enough. So why not just pay for the premiums? And I, by the way, I'm a big fan of protection for long-term care that has a very long elimination period. In other words, it doesn't cover, 6 months in a long-term care facility. It covers after maybe a year of being in a long-term care facility. That's the purpose of insurance, is to fund these very large risks. And there are long-term care policies that won't even fund a big risk. So that's not true protection. True protection is if you do have a very expensive long-term care event, that's going to get transferred. That risk is going to get transferred to an insurance company. And I guess, the good news of the COVID era is that it's not good news at all, but the financial strength of a lot of insurance companies that offered long-term care products is now better, because some of the most vulnerable nursing home patients haven't made it through the COVID era. So it's kind of a bizarre, if you're an actuary studying this kind of stuff, it's an interesting, unexpected event that has changed the market.
That's very interesting. Something else that you've written about, and it's making me think for folks that are aging, let's say maybe in their 70s and 80s, is thinking about cognitive decline and their different experiences of confidence when they make financial decisions. So can you just talk about, let's say for somebody that's maybe in their 50s and 60s and they have elderly parents, how should they be prepared to deal with their elderly parents if they're still trying to manage their own finances?
A good analogy is driving. So driving is a complex skill. It requires visual stimuli. You have to process it. You have to physically respond to those stimuli. And it's very similar to this the cognitive decline that you experience when you're making financial decisions, in that it declines at a very gradual rate each year. It's about 1 to 2 percentage points. And it's not a big deal. Like, your driving skills at 73 are not much different than at 74, but they're worse at 74. And if you have ever driven with a parent or a grandparent who's in their late 80s or early 90s, you know, after a couple of blocks, if you're in the passenger seat, you realize that you probably ought to switch seats, because they're not driving as well as they had. In fact, at some point, they really shouldn't be making highly complex decisions. They shouldn't be driving on the freeway in traffic, for example. They should take maybe a less heavily traveled way home. They shouldn't be driving at night. The same thing happens with your finances, that your ability to make complex financial decisions, and we've done, I think, a very thorough job of measuring it. By the time you hit your late 80s and early 90s, it's not what it was when you were in your 60s and 70s. So you need to plan for that ahead, to know that you're eventually going to need some help managing your finances. I think it's more important than ever now that instead of having pensions, we have to manage our IRAs to fund income and retirement. Our skills, our ability to decide how much to pull out, how to invest it, those decline in our 80s and 90s. So that's a significant source of vulnerability. Now, the problem is we don't recognize it. Yes. What happens is that if you ask a 90-year-old, how confident are you in your ability to make financial decisions, the confidence will be exactly the same as it was back in their 60s, because they just don't perceive this gradual decline in decision-making ability.
Yeah, that's. I think that could potentially pose a huge area of opportunity for savers that have parents that are elderly or financial advisors, to ensure to coach people before they get there, to have something set up within their estate plan or whatnot to make sure to protect against that, because that could be a huge risk for cognitive decline and elder abuse, you know, and financial issues. So something that I want to be able to touch on before we conclude is when I heard you speak way back in January or February of this year in 2020 at the Orange County FBA meeting. One of the things you talked about was just a shift in perspective of how retirees or seniors can think about independent living communities. And it was through the frame of reference of the retirement research on happiness. And I just found that to be really fascinating, because the perception, I think, of most either independent living communities or retirement communities just broadly, there's just such a negative viewpoint, and it's not very positive, but there might be another side of that story. So can you just talk a little bit about what are some of the benefits that retirement communities do offer for those in retirement?
Yeah, the research shows that living in your own home, living independently, makes you happier all the way up until you hit your roughly mid-80s. And once you hit your early to mid-80s, you're actually happier living in a different type of environment. And the reason that you change your preferences is because as you get older, your ability to maintain relationships with other people your age diminishes. You're not as able to drive around. You don't interact with people on a regular basis. So very often what happens when people do reach advanced age and they're living in their own home is they become very socially isolated. So I'm a big believer in recognizing that your optimal living environment when you get older is going to change. And planning for it earlier on in retirement is going to make every part of this experience so much easier. Because A, you recognize that there will be a transition eventually. You can pick where you want to live and what kind of lifestyle you want to have. You can even budget for the place that you want to live in. And then when you make the transition, it's on your own terms. It's not your kids having to move you into a different type of facility because you're not able to maintain your own home. It is, you know what, I realize that I'm going to change by the time I hit age 85. So maybe at age 80, you know, or some other age, I'm going to plan, I'm going to identify where I'm going to move to. I'm going to plan for transitioning to a different type of living environment that makes sense for me for that stage of my retirement lifestyle. And I think if you can do that early on in retirement, the chance of that transition being less emotionally negative for you, but also for your kids. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of moving an elderly person from their own home into a retirement home. But there's just nothing pleasant about that experience for anybody involved. If you can do it on your own terms, I think everybody is better off.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Michael, we have covered a range of topics. This is extremely fascinating. I appreciate all your insight. Is there anything else that you feel like you'd want to share for folks, again, that are maybe in that 50 to 60 range or trying to save for a successful retirement? Any final points, a sense of encouragement or things for they should be looking out for?
Well, I mean, the good news is that retirees do tend to be happier, and people get happier the older they are. So I think, you know, what's important for you and I to know is that actually the worst part of our life tends to be our 40s. And every decade after that, we tend to be happier than we were in middle age. So it is something to look forward to and be prepared for. And I think, you know, remember, the money is not everything. It's I think we can get focused too much on it as a scorecard about how successful we've been in life, but really it is access to the things that actually do make us happy. So the more we can plan for a lifestyle instead of just planning for our money, the happier we're probably going to be in retirement.
That's awesome. I really appreciate you joining us, Michael. I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thanks so much, Sean. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to The John Chapman Show. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. We encourage your questions, comments, and feedback. For additional information, check out thejohnchapmanshow.com or look for John on LinkedIn and Twitter. See you next week.